I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. President-elect Barack Obama has begun discussing the details of his economic stimulus plan. Well, today on the show, we have two Canadian experts with some smart ideas on public investments for the long term. Anthony Pearl is the director of the Urban Studies Program at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. He has also co-written an exciting book called Transport Revolutions, Moving People and Freight Without Oil. And we'll stay north of the border and speak with the president and CEO of the Canadian Urban Institute, Glenn Murray. Glenn is here to tell us about his experiences as both the mayor of Winnipeg and how investing in sprawling infrastructure will cost more in the long run. All this plus our regular contributors Walker Smith and Nate Berg coming up after the news on today's very Canadian Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. So much of our economy depends on moving people and goods around the country, around the world. And my first guest, Anthony Pearl, has written a provocative new book, along with Richard Gilbert, about the future of travel called Transport Revolutions, Moving People and Freight Without Oil. Anthony is also the director of the Urban Studies Program at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. Anthony, you write that a transport revolution is in the works. What's driving that revolution?
Well, the biggest driver is the changing energy futures that we're facing. 60% of the world's oil out there is used to fuel transportation, and over 95% of the world's transportation is powered by oil. That's a very concentrated energy source. There's reasons, both technical and political, as to why that's happened. But the bottom line is that in the next 10 years or less, there's not going to be enough oil available to meet growing demand for mobility of freight and people, and that's going to trigger changes in the organization and the technology of the way those work.
Is there now general agreement, Anthony, that in fact we're going to hit peak oil and there won't be enough oil to run transportation systems the way we've been running them?
No, I would say it's still a contested topic, and no doubt will be after the fact that it's obvious. That's certainly what happened with United States oil peaking in the early 1970s. People ridiculed M. King Hubbard, who was the American geologist who first discovered the concept of peak oil, even though the United States did peak in its oil output and now imports two-thirds of its oil. The big difference is that people think, well, we didn't run out of oil, we being the U.S., but they conveniently forget that two-thirds of the oil going through their SUVs and other vehicles comes from foreign countries, including Canada, where I live and work.
When we get past this oil availability, what does the other side of that look like? What are we revolving or evolving to?
Well, we're evolving to a period of uncertainty and instability. Just the extent of that kind of volatility and fluctuation is quite open. The more we plan for the future, the more my co-author Richard Gilbert and I feel we can manage that change. I think that we're looking at a reflection of this in the current economic uncertainty and turmoil that's out there. I don't think it's entirely coincidental that price of oil hit $147 a barrel at the time that the economy began to collapse in the Western world. So it looks a lot like what it is now and more of the same unless we have a plan to deal with it, which I'm afraid to say that we don't.
Well, that's a happy thought. What could transportation look like that is not so oil dependent?
In our book, we looked at a number of different options, and the only one that's really ready for prime time is the use of electric motors for surface and for some marine transportation and even for lighter-than-air ships for a niche of the aviation market. Electricity is the next best thing to oil when it comes to fueling transportation, and in many ways, certainly in terms of environmental impact, it's actually better. The key to remember is that electricity is not an energy source. It's an energy carrier. And by that I mean that you can blend and mix lots of different energy inputs into a power grid and then transmit them to vehicles, either directly or through battery storage, by means of electricity. The bottom line is the reason why oil became such a universal fuel source for transportation is because it's an excellent one. It carries a lot of energy for the density of the fuel. There is no one alternative out there that can replace oil, can do for us all that that oil has done, both for better and for worse. But electricity allows us to mix and match the different energy possibilities, especially renewable sources, wind, solar, hydroelectric power. The world has a lot of different endowments for renewable energy, but they're not all the same depending where you live and where the energy is used. And electricity allows that custom blending to go on in a way that will allow us to keep moving into the future.
It's interesting. I've never thought about electricity as a carrier rather than a source. So I appreciate the clarification there. What must we do to be ready to make this conversion that you talk about as the transportation revolution to electricity? Are we ready for it, or what will we need to do to get ready?
We need to develop an electric and a transportation system that can move electricity in fairly large amounts, larger than we do today, between cities. The U.S. needs to have its electric and its intercity transportation system strengthened at the same time, and we have a tremendous underused asset out there. And I said under rather than unused. It's the railroad network in North America. The railroads in most of the rest of the world actually run off of electricity today. That's why I said that this particular energy path is ready for prime time. Unlike hydrogen or biofuels or some of the other experimental possibilities that are used in small amounts in demonstration projects that have a lot of high hopes attached to them, electricity has been running trains and buses and even cars in some places for over 100 years. So this is not anything that requires a eureka moment in the laboratory to be scaled up to the needs of the present. In North America, for various reasons, with the exception of Boston to Washington, D.C. in the Northeast and a few other little bits, Chicago to South Bend being a little example in your part of the world, the railroad system has been run by diesel-electric motors. These are engines that basically generate the electricity on the train. And there is no wiring or catenary, as it's called, in place on our railroad network. Whereas if you go to Europe, you would find very few tracks that don't have that kind of electric infrastructure in place. So we've got the rights of way. We've got the corridors in place. And rather than trying to build a huge national transmission grid that requires condemning properties and going through all of the battles and mitigation that would be necessary to drive new corridors through built-up areas, we've got railroad rights of way that are in place that could carry that electricity. And at the same time, some of that electricity could run the trains that carry your orange juice and your books and other purchases over the internet to you, as well as expanding the capacity to move people by rail. In Europe, it's pretty much a commonplace. You can go from northern Sweden down to the tip of Italy without using a drop of oil in rail mobility and without any greenhouse gas emissions because they have an electric rail network, which we need to get busy on in our continent.
Let me make sure I understand. Can we produce the electricity we need domestically?
Yes, I think it can be done. How it's done, of course, is open to debate, just like everything else. But that's why I said that as an energy carrier, it's an open-ended source. Some people will want to put coal and nuclear into the grid, and there are going to be political debates about that and whether it's sustainable, whether clean coal is just an oxymoron or whether it's a real term. Let it be proven one way or the other and then decide. But there is enough renewable energy sources, particularly high-temperature solar. There's been research that's very promising that suggests that in the Mojave Desert, you could generate enough electricity from basically concentrating the sun's rays with parabolic mirrors onto energy generation units. And that could produce enough electricity to meet the entire U.S. needs. But it would require a huge transmission network, which we don't have, which is why the rail infrastructure is just waiting to be used. So it is possible to do it in different ways. And it's also possible to do it one step at a time. You know, you can add a bit of solar here, a bit of wind power there. T. Boone Pickens has plans to turn Texas into the Netherlands with all the windmills that he wants to put up there. I say let people try different things. This type of experimentation is okay because you have a transportation system that is ready to use the electricity wherever it comes from. The problem with experimenting with hydrogen and biofuels and these other things is that each time the experiment needs to be changed or fails, you have to change the entire transportation propulsion system again. An engine that uses hydrogen and an engine that uses biofuels are two entirely different creatures. Whereas an electric motor is identical whether it's running off of nuclear-generated, coal-generated, or solar-generated electricity. Once we get the electric transportation infrastructure in place, we never have to change it again. It's viable for an open-ended future, which is exactly the kind of diversity and robustness and resilience that we should be aiming for sustainability.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Anthony Pearl. He is co-author of the book Transport Revolutions, Moving People and Freight Without Oil, that he wrote with his co-author Richard Gilbert. Anthony, let's go back to oil a minute. I think most consumers are really confused about gas prices. They were the highest they've ever been this summer, and now they're the lowest they've been in years. Explain what's going on and what we can expect in the future.
I think this is a sign of a complex system starting to break down when you see that kind of a volatility. I guess I'm of an age, I don't know if you remember, there was a famous video, well, at that time it was a movie loop clip, of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge that basically shook itself apart in the 1960s, I think. And as a youngster, that clip really caught my attention. It's the visual example of what happens when external forces overwhelm a system that is carefully balanced. And I think that's what we're seeing with the volatility in oil right now. As I mentioned before, $147 a barrel oil was enough to kick some of the skids out from an already shaky world economy, which is now in a process of free fall, and oil prices are free falling along with it. We're not going to see economic recovery without a spike in oil prices down the road. Whether there'll be a bit of a lag or not is not clear. But I would say that one of the things that's happening is that oil production, future production, is being scaled back because of this financial crisis that we're in. In other words, the cheap oil, the Beverly Hillbillies oil, the kind where you stick a hole in the ground like they did in that comedy and it just comes gushing out, that's behind us. We've used most, if not all, of the Beverly Hillbillies oil that's out there. We need to now spend a lot of money to get oil. We're talking many hundreds of billions and some would say trillions of dollars. And with all the bailouts and other economic crisis management that's going on, those trillions are being put to other uses, and some might well say better uses right now. But what it means is that we're not drilling in the Arctic, and we're not going to be putting wells 5 miles under the Atlantic off the coast of Brazil, because the money isn't going into that. And all that means is that the plateau, if you will, or the drop-off when we start running out of Beverly Hillbillies oil even quicker, will be that much steeper. Because there won't be the unconventional oil, as it's known, the expensive remote location oil. That takes years to put into place, and the billions have to start flowing now. And the one thing I can tell you with some certainty is that they're not flowing as a result of the current global financial crisis.
If you were whispering in the president's ear, the president-elect in the U.S., and you were telling him how to use the economic stimulus package to get us to the transport revolution that you envision, what would you tell him to invest in?
I would tell him to invest in electric rail transportation and couple that with putting an electric high-voltage transmission grid around the country using the rail infrastructure that's out there, the rail networks that are in place. That would be a way to put money into job creation that will actually produce assets that have a increasing value in the future. Building more oil-fueled cars and building more highway lanes that are based on transportation powered by oil will have a depreciating value from day one. Sure, it'll create jobs, but the value of the assets that are produced by that kind of infrastructure will go down over time and quite substantially. I think we're going to be seeing a reduction in traffic. We did this summer. You know, U.S. Vehicle miles traveled went down by billions when gas was hovering at $4 a gallon. You don't need to be adding a single lane of new highway infrastructure in North America for the future. What we need is to be spending money on electric rail and bus transportation. We should be stringing wires over some of those highways for intercity bus and also for electric truck transportation as a part of that transition to the future. So there's plenty of infrastructure that's needed. All I would say is that virtually none of it is on the discussion list now, simply because transportation departments and railroads work in two different universes. The U.S. railroad network, with a few small exceptions, is almost entirely privately owned. And the transportation planning and construction side of things in states and the federal Department of Transportation focus on public assets, which are the highways and the airports. So we need to figure out a bridge to connect public and private to make this work. That's the first task, I would say, of a serious transportation and energy policy in the U.S.
What would that bridge look like?
Well, in the book, I've called, my co-author and I have called this an infrastructure condominium. Just like real condominiums in cities and buildings that you know more about than I do exist, where different ownership, titles to different ownership can exist on the same physical space, we would suggest that the railroads should retain the private ownership of their corridors, of their rights of way. That's kind of a sacred trust with the railways. They feel that they built their infrastructure privately. You know, whatever public subsidies and land grants went into them a century ago are past, but they insist that, you know, they have to pay taxes, which is true. They have to do all of the maintenance, and depreciation is pretty high in railroad assets, as it is with roads as well. So don't try and fight the railroad industry to nationalize the tracks, which would be a huge head-on collision. If we're in a total crisis mode, that might be the default option. But in the first instance, I would suggest, say, to the railroads, you get to keep your private asset, but we're going to turn what's built on top of it into a condominium. There will be publicly owned assets like wires and transmission lines, or maybe they'll actually be public and private. Maybe the private electric industry will be interested in obtaining some of these assets. But create a legal structure in place that allows different ownership on top of those rights of way, including additional tracks, because the railroads cannot raise enough capital. Even when the liar loans and the, you know, money was flowing with abandon into what turned out to be totally hopeless credit arrangements for subprime mortgages, even then the railroads could not convince the financial industry to lend them money to add and expand substantially their track capacity, which is why the freight railroads had such congestion problems in places like Chicago and other Midwestern and Western areas where all this container traffic was going. So the railroads are not going to be able to add more tracks to their rights of way, and there's space to do it in many places. We need to find a public finance mechanism to do that. The reason why the banks, even in their wild abandon, wouldn't lend money to the railroads for new tracks was they weren't going to compete against Uncle Sam's public investment on the highways. Even in, as I said, the financial exuberance that led us into this world crisis, the banks saw that difference and were not prepared to try and compete against Uncle Sam's financing. So the infrastructure condominium idea needs to be worked out. I'm sure that there's plenty of lawyers in Washington and other places who could flesh it out. But it offers a promising way to put public and private money together to rebuild and expand America's rail infrastructure and add electric capacity for both power and transportation where it's desperately needed.
I think that sounds like a stellar idea. Let's switch gears 1 minute. You also in your book, of course, deal with air travel. Recently, I heard Chicago Mayor Richard Daley say he believes we'll see a number of airport closings in mid-sized cities. Do you think that's a possibility?
In our book, we go out on a limb and say that past 2025, there's probably going to be 25 global hub airports, that's on planet Earth as a whole, that are functioning in the way that Chicago O'Hare or Atlanta Hartsfield or London Heathrow do today. That's 25. And remember, there's going to be a few of those in China and India and places like that. There's an awful lot of airports that are going to be just looking for new uses and new activities out there. And if we don't get serious about turning some of them into travel ports, as Hank Dittmar, who was head of the Reconnecting America Foundation and now works in England for Prince Charles and his foundation, Hank coined that term, travel ports. If we got serious about moving large numbers of people by train in the United States, one of the things we'd quickly discover is there aren't enough station spaces to get those trains in and out of major cities. Chicago, of course, does have a lot of train stations intact, but they're going to be busy for local transportation, as most of them are now. Most of the train travel in Chicago is on the local commuter agency, and people are going to be using that even more in an energy-challenged future. So the question is, where would people get on these high-speed trains? You know, if there was a train that went from Chicago to Springfield in an hour and change, or Chicago to Detroit in a couple of hours, where would people get on? Well, you're either going to have to build new stations or figure out a way to use some of that future capacity at these airports, which should become travel ports. So again, before anyone takes some of this stimulus money and starts building runways and other things that are dedicated to oil-based air transportation, the first priority should be to get tracks into the terminals, just like you would find, again, in Europe. If you go to Amsterdam, Frankfurt, Zurich, Charles de Gaulle Airport, you find not just one train track like the CTA for local transit service, but you find regional trains, you find high-speed trains, you find lots of tracks into airports there. They've been doing that for the last 20 years. Again, this is not rocket science. It's proven. The arrangements are there. We just have to get on with getting this done. So I would say that for a lot of airports in the U.S., their future depends on turning themselves into travel ports as opposed to waiting for the planes to just disappear.
Well, Anthony, this is such an interesting and very timely discussion as the U.S. tries to muddle through with this economic stimulus package. And I appreciate your advice and thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure, Carol. Thank you.
Anthony Pearl is the director of the Urban Studies Program at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, and his book, written with Richard Gilbert, is Transport Revolutions, Moving People and Freight Without Oil. We have a link to Anthony's work on our website, smartcityradio.com. Now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
If housing's needed, Gordon Brown wants to build it. The British Prime Minister has announced plans to overstep traditional planning rules to enable more housing to be built in rural areas, despite environmental concerns. According to a recent article from the Times of London, the new rules would instruct small villages and towns to identify building sites where affordable housing is needed, ignoring past policies that prevented such projects in the name of environmental protections. Brown's proposal would offer incentives to farmers willing to sell off agricultural land for development and encourage the development of new communities on the outskirts of existing towns. It's all part of a nationwide plan to build 3 million new units of affordable housing by 2020. While housing is in dire need in Britain, many worry that policies that ignore long-held planning principles may lead to uncontrolled sprawl. In Oregon, another sweeping reform is gathering political clout. An article from the Corvallis Gazette Times reports that Governor Ted Kulongoski is in favor of a plan to replace the state's gas tax with a fee based on how many miles Oregonians drive. The state has been studying this idea since 2007 when it installed GPS-enabled technology into thousands of test cars and levied a fee based on the vehicle miles traveled. Officials are looking at this idea as a way to keep the state's transportation fund alive. That funding currently comes from the state's 24-cent gas tax. Many worry that rising fuel efficiency and the popularity of public transit could mean less and less tax revenue for Oregon's transportation fund. The transition plan and its logistics could take years to work out, but if Kulongoski has his way, 2009 could be the year the legislative ball gets rolling. But it could also be the year a lot of other balls stop rolling, or at least slow down significantly. Retail has been one of the major victims of the economic recession, and industry experts are forecasting even more dismal times ahead. Consumers in recent months have been buying less and aren't expected to start buying more anytime soon. With declining revenues, some stores are closing their doors for good. A recent article from CNN Money puts expected store closures at more than 14,000 in 2009, one of the highest amounts ever recorded. And these closures will likely run across the board. From shopping malls and big boxes to chain stores and strip malls, retailers of all shapes and sizes are going to see a decidedly tougher market this year, as will the cities that rely on their tax revenues. And as markets respond to this recession, it should be interesting to see what types of retail will survive and which will falter in 2009. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with Glenn Murray, who is president and CEO of the Canadian Urban Institute. Glenn has a number of ideas on how to spend for long-term gain. You're listening to Smart City. And for our podcast listeners, we have a special message. Here's our producer, Scotty Iseri.
Hi, Carol. How's it going?
It's always going great.
The show is going well so far?
Well, that's for the listener to decide.
Well, speaking of our listeners, we have this really great base of podcast listeners, right? We have thousands of people that download our show every week. They come to our site, they click on the link, and they download our show, and they can take Smart City with them wherever we go. And we often get really great comments and feedback from them on our site. So we thought, why don't we create a site for our podcast listeners? It's called My City. It's got forums. It's a social networking site strictly for the listeners of Smart City.
Well, I think it would be fun to get to know the listeners better because we're all in this together. We're all trying to learn how to make cities more successful, our own cities more successful. So I'd love to hear what listeners have to say and love to learn more about what they're doing, the experiences they're having, what they see that's interesting, exciting, fun, cutting edge in their cities, some of which I'd love to turn into interviews.
Exactly, and that's what My City is all about. So what I'm asking the podcast listeners to do is email me, my personal email, I'm giving this out, and I'll send you an invite, join our social networking site, join My City, and make My City your city. It's Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com.
We look forward to hearing from you. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Our next guest, Glenn Murray, has a rich career. As the mayor of Winnipeg, he founded a coalition of mayors from the five large Canadian cities and chaired the Big City Mayors Caucus in 2002. Glenn is now president and CEO of the Canadian Urban Institute, a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing the quality of life in urban areas across Canada and internationally. Glenn, what is the state of Canada's cities today?
The last few years have been really fits and starts. We were in a period a few years ago under Prime Minister Paul Martin where there was a major elaboration of a national urban strategy. The former mayor of Vancouver, Michael Harcourt, was invited to develop a national urban strategy in Canada, which was completed just after the defeat of the Martin government and the election of the Harper Conservatives, and it was essentially ignored. And so the idea of the federal government engaging as a significant partner, given that it gets about 60% of the tax revenues collected in Canada, has sort of ended. The one thing that was salvaged was the transfer from the federal government through the provinces to municipalities of the equivalent of 5 cents a liter of the federal excise tax on gas. So fiscally, that's where things are at. Provincially, fairly quiet across the country with two exceptions. Very aggressive urban agenda in Ontario, a new legislative framework and more autonomy for large cities like Toronto, and a significant reversal of years of downloading and considerable cash transfers to municipalities for transit and transportation, and the development of a plan that actually won the Daniel Burnham Award. A lot of regional regional planning and sustainable planning. And the other place that's quite exciting right now is British Columbia and Vancouver, where lots of investments in transportation, 11.25 cents of the provincial gas tax going to transportation planning. Other than that, not much progress in most other parts of the country right now, unfortunately.
Why do you think there's hostility by the Canadian government toward its cities? I mean, especially when cities, as you say, produce 60% of the revenue for the nation.
Well, we're sort of in the reverse of the United States, where you've now got a blue state president, Congress, and we have essentially our equivalent of what would be a red province, if I can use that expression, government, which really has a fairly anti-urban agenda, is playing rather divisive politics of arguing that cities don't need help, they're not going to vote for the Conservative Party, which is the party in power right now anyway. And there's been a fairly successful campaign by them in the face of relatively weak opposition to really take the 905 suburban belts, which in Canada would be the outer ring suburbs, and marry their a political agenda that marries them to rural and small towns in Canada. So it's almost an anti-urban coalition. It's a suburban-rural coalition. It's a very focused on building wealth from the export of raw resources. No industrial policy, no national transit policy. The federal government's position on urban regions and urban economies, culture, social development, immigration, human settlement, is that these are provincial responsibilities and the federal government ought not to get involved in it. But then deciding to put a rapid transit route out from Toronto to a city called Peterborough, where only 900 people would ever use it. It was pointed out by most people that you could buy each of those people a late model Mercedes-Benz to commute to work at lower costs than that, and really not investing in mass transit in the core urban areas of the Greater Toronto Area. So you have this sort of tinkering regional minister kind of politics of pet projects for my backyard again, rather than working with cities on coherent regional plans, which was where we were at a few years ago, and we sort of abandoned that.
In this economic downturn, several U.S. cities have already asked the federal government for their own bailouts. What's your opinion on that?
I sort of share the perspective of my friend John Norquist, the former mayor of Milwaukee, who makes the point that what cities don't need is greater dependence on federal revenues in Canada and the United States. What cities do need is to really vacate tax room and allow municipalities to have a more diverse range of revenue sources, especially ones that aren't as economically destructive of property taxes, which property taxes is the sole source of revenue for most cities. The real huge disincentive to quality development. Every time you improve your building, even if it's to green your building, make it more energy efficient, you're getting hit with a penalizing tax. So property taxes are quite a brown form of taxation, especially because they really don't tax land. They really essentially are a tax on buildings in the built environment. They don't grow with the economy. Cities are very smart about intensification, transit, walkable neighborhoods. Property taxes don't reward cities for smart investments. They don't grow with the economy. So we don't have a good mechanism. What we do is we leave the burden of responsibility for fixing cities on the ratepayers and on the municipal treasury. And when they do get it right, they don't get the revenue back that they need to sustain that level of investment, whether it's in transit or transportation infrastructure or policing. In Canada, this tax system is so perverse that, you know, I own a business in downtown Toronto. We pay 300% more property taxes based on the assessment system, and we're near a rapid transit line than we would if we were a business out in a commercial or industrial park far away from transit and greenfield development that was energy intensive and forced all of our employees to take cars and use a lot of infrastructure rather than fairly low environmental footprint that we have being in a heritage building in a very dense part of town. So the multiplier factors for taxing the kind of development that most official plans and most sustainability strategies say we want more of, we tax several times the rate in Canada, and we heavily subsidize low density, high energy use, poor quality developments in greenfields. And until we get that right, the tax guy and the city assessor are going to drive the urban agenda, not the people who are doing sustainable regional planning.
What sources make more sense as tax streams for cities?
I think that some of the things make sense depending on the region. I really believe that consumption taxes make the most sense. I believe that we should be moving to carbon taxes and taxes on pollution and taxes on vehicle emissions and vehicle use, rolling toll systems, those kinds of things should fund cities. And there should also be tax revenue associated with mixed-use development that actually recognizes that there's a knowledge and creative economy out there that is emerging, not in industrial parks or in separately zoned land, but in the heart and soul of historic and residential neighborhoods. And to be able, through a share of the existing corporate and income tax, reinvesting that into kinds of investments that cities make in infrastructure that's critical to developing a knowledge and creative economy. So sales tax, carbon taxes, and carbon taxes particularly, because cities are responsible for transportation and transportation planning and transit. So the costs of moving to lower greenhouse gas emissions, to carbon neutrality, are going to be borne mostly by municipal and regional governments. And the taxation that's required to put a proper price on carbon dioxide, to allow for investments in green technologies and green environments and green neighborhoods, that price is important both to driving change and in capturing the revenue you need to repurpose and redefine and rebuild a more sustainable urban environment.
Do you think there are nations that are doing a much better job than Canada and the U.S.?
Yeah, I think the United Kingdom is, and Sweden particularly, have done an extraordinary job. I think Singapore is doing some extraordinary things. Iceland, there's a woman who's now the leader of the opposition of the Social Democratic Party in Iceland, a woman named Ingeborg Solrun Gisladóttir, who really got into, even before Richard Florida and many others were talking about it. So I think there's many places that are getting it right. I think we're past the 11th hour now, and the inertia in so many countries is so strong that it's almost impossible. We're locked into greenhouse gas emissions and particularly carbon dioxide. The emission levels that are in the atmosphere right now aren't going to be felt for another 50 years. And we know that that's going to mean by mid-century that we've lost 35% of the species on this planet. And I don't think we have taken a sober or serious enough look at this, nor do I think politicians and leaders have been candid enough with Americans and Canadians particularly, and particularly our countries, not just because we're higher energy users. No other country has such a healthy, well-educated population. No other two countries in the world have the kind of technology-educated workforce at their fingertips, nor the amount of capital, even in this capital crunch. There is no two wealthier countries in the world that can mobilize capital and technology to solutions, and we are simply failing to play that leadership as the countries that should be leading in global solutions and exporting that technology to China to get them off their fossil fuel and the coal-based economic development and renewal. And it seems to me that when the history books are written, if we survive the next century, this generation will be looked at the one that inherited most from a generation that had the very least, and the generation, our generation, with the very most, left the most horrible and pathetic legacy to our children. And I think we've got, for us baby boomers, we've got another 10 or 20 years to fix this, and we better get to work.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Glenn Murray of the Canadian Urban Institute. We're talking about his prescription for cities that want to survive this economic downturn. From your position at the Canadian Urban Institute, your leadership position there, are you making this case with urban leaders, and do they get it, and do they know where to begin?
No, I think the problem are two eyes. One is innovative policies and innovative technologies. We are using the same transportation technologies. We are still using, urban form. You know, when we have these special green projects, and I'm going to recognize one later today that's a very exciting project by a group called Artscape called the Green Barns Project, which is a very exciting adaptive reuse of the built environment, repurposing an old transit barn to new creative and green economy. These things tend to stand alone as sort of exceptional pilot projects. Well, 95% of the urban and suburban environment that is being created is low density, high energy, low quality, not durable buildings, highly auto dependent, culturally dead environments that are very banal, and more than being banal, they're environmental disasters in the making. We're not changing that. It's still green the green environments, green buildings, green technology, green transportation, any kind of innovation is sort of someone's pet project or a demonstration project. There is none of the mechanisms in training carpenters, builders, engineers, and deploying technology, new construction, new insulation, new understandings of how you can organize and build cities, move to a low energy environment. None of that is being mass deployed right now. So there's the failure to use new technologies, there's the failure to innovate, and there's the failure to implement. Without innovation and without implementation, what we have is repetition of formulaic late 20th century high energy environments. And that's a disaster in the making. Part of it is pricing. These are heavily subsidized forms of development and a failure of national leadership. I mean, I think that there is some hope in the United States right now in the election of Barack Obama and Joe Biden, and a much richer understanding, we hope, coming out of the U.S., that hopefully Americans will embarrass Canadians and our rather tepid national government that is governing with a rather brown policy base and brown taxation system. Hopefully we can get embarrassed into being inspired by the leadership we see south of the border, because up here right now it's pretty sad, with a few exceptions. British Columbia, Gordon Campbell, the premier there, and Dalton McGuinty in Ontario, and a fellow named Gary Doer, who's the premier in Manitoba. Those three provinces have very dynamic green premiers who are really running against the tide of the national government in trying to manage the shift to a low-carbon economy and understanding the vital role of cities, urban transportation systems, and the suburban residential form as critical elements of that transformation.
You mentioned our dependence on automobiles, and you also mentioned this inattention to durability, and those both bring to mind the increasing calls in the U.S. for new infrastructure investments as a way to solve the jobs problem in the short term with this economic downturn. I know you've thought a lot, written a lot about infrastructure, and you've been speaking of it, alluding to it anyway, and from a sustainability standpoint, how do we make infrastructure, invest in infrastructure in ways that will reduce the carbon footprint, reduce our energy consuming lifestyles. But you've also talked about infrastructure, investing in infrastructure that in fact adds something to the quality of life and the beauty of a city. Talk a little bit about that. Is that still appropriate? Is that an appropriate conversation given the economic downturn?
Carol, I think it's more than appropriate. I think it's essential. I really believe that if you properly zone and design a rapid transit line and make it beautiful and make each of the stations mobility hubs and commercial and cultural hubs so that you're walking out into a town square and in commercially intensive area, great public art, and you're in a highly walkable area, and it is less expensive to serve, especially with our aging population, you immediately generate much higher property values and much more intensive economic activity. And you recover, if you are financing these things by debentures over 25 years, you are generating a much higher level of return on that investment that exceeds the cost of those infrastructure investments. So you should make money. If you're building large regional highway systems into low-density neighborhoods, you never recover the cost. I don't know of traditional suburban form that isn't now exhausting the treasuries of most suburban municipal governments surrounding the urban areas. Most of them, you know, are now curbing growth because they're realizing that every additional subdivision they add drives more cost than it does revenue, and they don't have the commercial base or the density of an urban core to support it. The economics of it simply don't work. On the cultural side, it is the quality of place, the culture and openness and celebration of diversity. It is the capacity of their technology, the ability to embrace and generate new technology that is really driving that. But it really comes back to people being extremely critical about the kinds of places they want to live in, and the quality and aesthetics and cultural richness and openness and fluidity of a society determine whether those places are people magnets. And then if they are people magnets and they're retaining and attracting that creative, dynamic workforce, then of course they're tending to be much more prosperous than regions aren't.
Let me ask you one more question, Glenn. Put yourself in the role of a U.S. mayor today. Very strapped financial conditions, all mayors are now cutting their budgets, not in small ways, but in very big ways, as you know. They probably have unfunded public pensions. So times are tough. What would you do over the near term, the next, let's say, 24, 36 months? What would you be thinking about as a mayor? What would you be doing to put your city in the best position to succeed?
I sort of was there. Winnipeg, of the 10 largest cities in Canada, was, when I became mayor, had the poorest economy, had the highest per capita debt of any municipality. It had the highest per capita property taxes of any major municipality. And it was depopulating by 2,000-4,000 people per year. And in the historic center of the city, the vacancy rate was about 60%. So it wasn't a happy time. I joke that I got the job probably because no one else wanted it. What we did was, and I think what we forget, is that the real value and revenue and the way you build out of a problem isn't going to be dependent on help from other orders of government, as critical as they are. And you almost hope that states and provinces just stop doing really stupid things to cities that undermine the critical mass of cities that give them the economy of scale. But what we did is we just looked at all of the buildings in our downtowns, but they were all empty. And we realized that we had undervalue asset. And one of the ways we started to build our tax base was to say, okay, so buildings are now generating, when they're not vacant, $8 a square foot rent. And they have to be generating $22 or $23 a square foot rent if people are going to invest in them. So how do you get from there to where we need to go? And we did an economic and value map of the entire commercial centers across the city, realized what the gaps were, allowed people who bought up those empty buildings to write off the difference between what they were generating in rent and what they had to be generating to pay for the restoration of the buildings. That worked very well, especially when we allowed people to get a loan from the city against those tax credits to get some seed capital to start doing that. And we had in our downtown within about 2 years, 36 empty bank buildings and warehouses that were, 50, 100, 300, 400,000 square foot building, completely revitalized and back in the market. And it didn't cost us anything because people weren't even tearing these buildings down because they were worth so little money that tearing them down would cost you more than what the value of the vacant land would be after the building was torn down. So that was the only reason they were left standing. So that was it. It was also using pricing and incentives, also understanding that if you start to introduce public transit, if you take public monopolies like libraries and in places where liquor stores are state monopolies, you put one of those at either end of the block, you start to put rapid transit in there, you rezone to 24-hour neighborhood, you allow people to move in residentially into these fabulous old buildings, all of a sudden you start building your tax base rather than your tax burden. And our biggest revenue sources in Winnipeg came from the restoration of our downtown by giving tax forgiveness on buildings that weren't paying taxes, so we weren't really losing anything, but they were going to pay taxes once people invested in them. And by people not having to pay those taxes for sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, changed the economics of investment and attracted a lot of capital to those buildings. I think it was a 43% jump in downtown. A lot of what can be done is by using the spending power and the tax systems of municipalities and good planning and good collaborative governance models in development corporations between the private and public sector to drive that and to get rid of bad infrastructure. I mean, in San Francisco, when the Embarcadero Freeway collapsed, 2 years later, they noticed that property values in that area were up 300%. John Norquist in Milwaukee, the mayor a few years ago, tore down the freeways only to realize that he could use tax increment financing to completely replace them with boulevards and public transit as an alternative because values went up so much in downtown Milwaukee after the freeway came down. So redirecting and reconstituting the urban environment by getting rid of bad and energy-intensive transportation infrastructure also has a value proposition. So it's really looking at wealth generation and tax base building exercises.
Well, Glenn, it's always a real pleasure to catch up with you. So I thank you so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, Carol, thank you for your advocacy and the education you do. Thanks to you from up here.
Glenn Murray is the president and CEO of the Canadian Urban Institute. We have a link to his site at ours, smartcityradio.com. While we're all waiting for the economy to be stimulated, our City Views commentator Walker Smith brings us a thought about the simple life and how simplicity can be very, very complicated.
It wasn't too long ago that voluntary simplicity seemed pretty attractive. In the midst of our consumption frenzy for the last 30 years, getting out of the rat race and shopping less had a lot of appeal for a lot of people. Nowadays, though, shopping too little looks a lot worse than shopping too much. The impact of the current economic slowdown is a mark of just how much our well-being is tied to economic growth, which is fueled by consumption. If we don't buy, then there is no commerce to create the prosperity that affords many of us the luxury of being able to choose to live simpler lives. Indeed, since September, we have seen firsthand what happens when shopping stops. Stores shut down, businesses slow down, and jobs are cut down. The coffers of state and local governments dry up because tax receipts drop. When people buy less, sales taxes bring in less. When people earn less, income taxes bring in less. And when people's homes are worth less, property taxes bring in less. This means significantly reduced services and protections. And the list goes on. People have less money for charitable donations. Animal shelters fill up with pets people can no longer afford to feed. College endowments lose value, so programs are cut and downsized. Even recycling suffers because the demand for recycled materials dries up when there is no demand for the products these materials are used to make. To put it bluntly, if somewhat dramatically, the entire structure of society teeters when consumption grinds to a halt. Without enough commerce to fund and create our shared prosperity, life doesn't get simpler at all. We would be forced to work much harder to put food on the table, and we would have to do many more things ourselves that public services do for us now. Adopted en masse, voluntary simplicity is a paradox of surprisingly greater difficulties and burdens. A few of us can drop out and live off the grid, but if too many of us do so, the result is a brutish economic and social retrenchment. Unfortunately, we seem to have done just that. All at once, we have closed our pocketbooks and dropped out of the marketplace. En masse, we are learning to live without, which is the very same thing as voluntary simplicity, only we are calling it economizing. Eventually, a day will come when we are confident enough to start shopping again. But we must make sure that we learn the right lesson from this downturn. If we decide that spending is to be avoided, then we virtually ensure that our overall well-being will be compromised. What got us into this predicament wasn't spending. It was recklessness. We need to find the happy medium between spending with abandon and abandoning spending. Our prosperity depends upon avoiding these two extremes and finding a balance that creates commerce enough for us to thrive. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. If you want to hear more from Smart City, go to our website, smartcityradio.com, where you can listen to archive shows and get links to the work of our guest. While you're there, sign up for our newsletter or get in touch with us and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Additional support provided by National Trust Main Street Center, revitalizing America's traditional business districts to build sustainable communities. Visit www.mainstreet.org. Scotty Iceri is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.